Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Hour of the Time with your host here, Doyle Shamley, in Eager, Arizona, on this wonderful, fine June evening, 2008. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. You can thank yourself for what you're going to learn this evening. But first, our contact information. If you'd like to write the Hour of the Time, you may do so by writing Hour of the Time, or HOT, H-O-T-T, P.O. Box 940, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Again, that's Hour of the Time, P.O. Box 940, Eager, Arizona, 85925. The website, hourofthetime.com, that's hourofthetime.com. The studio number, 928-333-2942. And my personal email address, hourofthetime@hotmail.com. That's hourofthetime@hotmail.com. Now, a few other quick reminders. Don't forget our conference 2008 coming up in October. I suggest you go to our website, hourofthetime.com, and look at the page and look at the schedule and the events. And there's a lot of extracurricular events that aren't even in the schedule. The schedule, so you have an idea of what's being taught when. But there's stuff every evening as well. We have alternative energy displays that will be on site that you can do yourself at home, for instance, as well as some special guests coming through that are experts in their field that will entertain on the side classes, etc., or in the evenings. There's also some night orienteering work that I will be conducting, and you don't have to attend it if you don't want to. It's just going to be available, because I already know some people do want to. We will teach you how to navigate in total darkness. I think you'll find that quite interesting. But ladies and gentlemen, because the time is coming up and people are grabbing slots, we are limiting this year more so than we ever have. So you had better get on the ball, because you need to make travel arrangements and arrangements around your home, whatever that might be, with your employer, let's say, whatever. So get ready and get moving. If you have any questions, you need details, special circumstances, diet, facilities, whatever, just email me directly, hourofthetime@hotmail.com, and I'll be glad to work with you. We do that every year with more than one person, so it's no big deal. But you won't get an event like this anywhere else from anybody, and if you did, you definitely wouldn't get it for such a low price. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, the gears have been turning, and the classes we've picked has been very purposeful as the conferences have developed and changed over the years, because we're going to reach a point where these will not be activities that are even allowed. So we've been training and preparing you and giving you the research that you can stand on your own two feet no matter what comes your direction. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I also want to put out my thanks to all those who helped the Hour of the Time. We are listener-supported, and those behind the scenes who keep this operation running, all those in Canada that do the work and all across the United States, people that helped me with research all over from different walks of life, everybody from Brian to the Scotts to the Richards to Tom's and Jerry's all over the country. I constantly get this data from multiple sources all around and outside of our continent even. And that's how we're able to synthesize and have such good research here at the Hour of the Time and do these events and go speak as authoritative experts on these subject areas all around the country. Besides just the broadcast, there is a lot of face-to-face engagements that I do that most of you just don't even realize. Last week I had 2 speaking engagements with business professional groups. People are starting to wake up. The most effective tool is face-to-face. That's, for instance, why we do the conferences. It's much more effective than like some of the so-called patriots out there that are just a different media agency, and they're still just talking heads, babbling about the same thing every night. They don't give you a solution. They don't give you a how-to, stand on your own 2 feet. And we do. And these face-to-face meetings, talking to businessmen and women, talking to the everyday guy or the professor or the legislator, and on and on and on, why it's so effective. Actually, I had 3 last week. I forgot about Saturdays. And another one this Saturday, too, so I have a couple, 3 this week to do, starting Thursday. And I was supposed to be at one, actually, yesterday evening and this evening, both, but 2 swamped, ladies and gentlemen. Even I need some sleep occasionally and some rest. So squeeze out a show, a broadcast, and then take my boots off and relax a little and actually spend some time with family and friends. But tonight's broadcast is a continuation of a series I did, 3 months back or so, 4 months back. And this is new material. And it's the state-sponsored socialism, the creation of a welfare state. And what we're going to get into tonight in the broadcast is the effects we did all the leading up to in the late 1800s and in the 1900s and up to the World War II period. Now we're going to get into the actions and events from a historical perspective of the Cold War era, as it's been termed by historians. And we'll give you quotes, references, bibliography to go look up just like before. And all this, believe it or not, does lead up to an ultimate grand design, if you will. So to understand it, and to keep horrible events from happening again, you have to understand history. And that's what we're giving you, is a history lesson on how we've gotten more and more towards socialism in this country. Because state-sponsored socialism, or welfare states, doesn't apply just to here. I'm not talking about just 50 United States. There's also foreign aid that's used as a tool, hooking countries on another version, foreign aid, of welfare, so that they become pawns in the game as well. We're going to go into it first. I'll hit on some bibliographical highlights, some key players, and little biographical sketches, if you will, concerning them. And then we will get on to historical data. So as always, make sure you have something to write with after the musical break. Now I will take a quick musical break here. Get your notes and writing instruments ready and be prepared to learn a whole bunch of facts and events and people that shaped state-sponsored socialism during the Cold War era. right, ladies and gentlemen, again, your host here, Doyle Shamley in Eager, Arizona, with an addition to our series, State-Sponsored Socialism, the Creation of a Welfare State. And first, let's get to some key historical reference points as we talk in this evening's broadcast about the Cold War era and its effects to our policies, both foreign and domestic. Now, some key dates you need to remember, and famous speeches and persons, etc. 1946, Churchill's Iron Curtain speech at Fulton, Missouri. 1947, United States aid to Greece and Turkey. 1948, the Berlin blockade. April 1949, NATO formed. November 1949, communist rule established in China. 1950, the Korean conflict begins, as it's called, or the Korean War. 1953, the armistice in Korea. 1955, Bangdung Conference of Asian African Nations. 1956, revolts in Poland and Hungary. 1959, Castro establishes communist rule in Cuba. 1960, the U-2 crisis. 1962, United States becomes deeply involved in the war in Vietnam. 1963, the nuclear atmospheric test ban. 1967, the Glasgow summit. 1972, Nixon goes to Peking. 1973, ceasefires in Vietnam. United States begins withdrawal. 1979, Vienna summit. The SALT II agreement. 1983, Soviets shoot down Korean Airlines passenger plane. Now that will be just a few key events you'll need to remember. And as far as bibliographical references, I want you to look up these books, if you would. You will learn a lot from them. We'll give author, title, as always. Keith Eubank, The Summit Conferences, 1919 to 1960. Winston S. Churchill, Closing the Ring. Also by Winston S. Churchill, Triumph and Tragedy. Samuel E. Morrison, with one S, Morrison, The Oxford History of the American People. Hugh Seton Watson, a hyphenated last name, Hugh Seton Watson, From Lenin to Malenkov. Marguerite Higgins, Our Vietnam Nightmare. Commager, Documents of American History, Volume 2. Anthony Kubek, How the Far East Was Lost. Courtney Whitney, MacArthur, His Rendezvous with History. John W. Spanier, The Truman-MacArthur Controversy and the Korean War. Eric F. Goldman, The Crucial Decade and After. Ralph De Toledano, The Greatest Plot in History. Roy Cohn, McCarthy. John Rorty and Moshe Dechter, McCarthy and the Communists. And Kapranov, this is a very important reading, all of them are important, but The USSR and Industrial Development of Newly Free States, Internationalism, National Liberation, and Our Epoch. And finally, what will be a good end of the bibliography for tonight and the next few nights, Lewis Koenig, The Truman Administration, Its Principles and Practices. Now, a few quotes are in order, I believe, ladies and gentlemen, that kind of wrap up a lot of the sentiment and the history of the time leading into and through much of the Cold War. Winston Churchill said in 1946, from the Baltic to the Adriatic, an Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must consider the Soviet sphere, and all are subject to Soviet influence and, in many cases, increasing measures of control from Moscow. Again, Winston Churchill, 1946. Harry Truman, 1947. The peoples of a number of countries of the world have recently had totalitarian regimes forced upon them against their will. The very existence of the Greek state is today threatened by the terrorist activities of armed men led by communists who defy the government's authority. In addition to funds, I ask the Congress to authorize the detail of American civilian and military personnel to Greece. Now, in an act of Congress from 1954, it was found, quote, "The Congress hereby finds and declares that the Communist Party of the United States, although purportedly a political party, is in fact an instrumentality of a conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States." And then to John F. Kennedy in 1962, "Whereas the peace of the world and the security of the United States are endangered by the establishment by the Sino-Soviet powers of a military capability in Cuba, now therefore I, John F. Kennedy, do hereby proclaim that the forces under my command are ordered to interdict the delivery of offensive weapons and associated material to Cuba." Those are a few important quotes, ladies and gentlemen, around the Cold War era, as it's called. Now, many of you may be familiar with Winston Churchill's multi-volume history of World War II, and he called the last volume in this set Triumph and Tragedy. Now, he gave a reason for choosing that title, and he covered it in a single sentence. Quote, "I have called this volume Triumph and Tragedy because the overwhelming victory of the Grand Alliance has failed so far to bring general peace to our anxious world." End quote. It was clear that his brief statement, ladies and gentlemen, was an understatement of what he called a tragedy. It's not simply that wars have been promulgated and occurred between several countries since the end of World War II. The big tragedy, ladies and gentlemen, I feel, is that all the weapons of World War II barely went silent before a worldwide struggle began. And that was the struggle that started the move towards world socialism, the very fight we find ourselves in today. It was a struggle started by expansive communism and what was remaining of Western civilization. In other words, this was the era of the Cold War. And ladies and gentlemen, Churchill was well aware of it before he ever wrote Triumph and Tragedy. Remember the speech I told you about and the key date there in 1946 in Fulton, Missouri? He introduced the phrase Iron Curtain. He didn't publish Triumph and Tragedy till 1953, 7 years later. And he made a very good summary of Soviet communism and its expansion going on at the time. What he meant by the Iron Curtain really was that as the Soviet Union and communism expanded and socialism, it basically shut off normal communications and interchanges with the rest of the world, trade, etc. Unless, of course, it was through our State Department aiding them. By early 1946, for example, ladies and gentlemen, it was already happening or had happened in Poland, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Albania. And we played you recordings of people that were in Hungaria, Hungarian freedom fighters, actual recordings from people that were there. In Italy and France, there were strong communist parties thrusting always forward for more and more political power. And for instance, in a great number of countries, far from the Russian countries, far from the Russian frontiers and throughout the world, just like we saw here in America and we still see today, communist fifth columns were established and work in complete unity and absolute obedience, ladies and gentlemen, to the directions they receive from the world movement. And the communist fifth columns are a growing challenge still today and a very peril to Christian civilization. Now, at the end of World War II and its ensuing years, the situation was ripe for communism and socialism to take advantage of the situation. Western Europe, for instance, which had always been a major center of power and influence radiating outward on the world, was basically in a complete power vacuum. Germany and their political and military systems were crushed. They didn't even have a recognized or a de facto government, in fact, at the end of the war. It was disarmed, most of its industrial potential destroyed by bombings, or carted away and stolen by the Russians, and then divided into four zones of occupation. France had been clearly exposed as an ineffective minor power by the Nazi armies within just a few weeks, and was basically incapable of resuming roles as a major power for decades. Italy really hadn't been a power of consequence in the modern era. Eastern Europe had been overrun by communist armies. And as they installed governments dependent upon directions from Moscow, did they only slightly loosen their grip for public image sake? England maintained its posture as a world power during World War II, but exposure of many of its weaknesses came about. Britain had never really been, for instance, a major military power by land. And it only regained the initiative against the Axis because of aid from the Allies. A lot of that, the United States and Canada. The British Navy retired from the Pacific in the face of the Japanese offensive, and its long-time position in the Eastern Mediterranean was seriously challenged. Britain visibly retreated after World War II from world status power and quickly became a minor power in all but the name and actions behind the scenes. The change was accelerated quite clearly, ladies and gentlemen, by socialism. Elections were held shortly after, for instance, the defeat in Germany in 1945, and the Labour Party won. Churchill, the symbol of British determination, was replaced by Clement Attlee, a man fully committed to socializing the British economy. And within 2 years of headlong nationalization of industries, Britain had become a land of grave shortages of goods and was seeking loans to survive. And democratic socialists are well known for their opposition to an assertive role in international affairs, often claiming they're pacifists, and invariably favor compromise and negotiation, but they were full steam ahead behind the scenes as well. And in fact, laborites, if you will, as in those following the Labor Party schemes, withdrew using their power of the British Empire from protectorates and colonies as quick as they could, consolidating power into the sphere of Moscow. What remained, ladies and gentlemen, essentially in the following years after World War II, was merely a symbolic relationship of the British Empire, and it was known as the Commonwealth of Nations. Japan's empire, also after World War II, acquired before and during World War II, was taken away everything, as was that of Italy and North Africa. The United States granted independence to the Philippines following the war. Indochina, the French gave up, Northern Africa, and elsewhere. Belgians withdrew from Congo. Dutch gave up their Pacific empires. And guess what? All of these old long-term colonies and protectorates were happy hunting grounds for socialist and communist influence. In the late 1940s, for instance, it was essentially nip and tuck as to whether or not communists might gain control of governments in France and Italy. And it did. Weaknesses all around the world in these newly freed protectorates, commonwealths, were an opportunity to Stalin and those around him who were bent on spreading communists, power and influence, and socialism throughout the world. And in fact, that communism would inevitably triumph in every country on the earth was the dogma that every leader of that persuasion was committed to. Marx predicted it, Lenin affirmed it, Stalin proceeded ahead, and those who followed continued to profess that belief, ladies and gentlemen. Let's look at Nikita Khrushchev, who succeeded Stalin as dictator, for instance, of the Soviet Union. He declared in 1959, "We believe that the idea of communism will ultimately be victorious throughout the world, just as it had been victorious in our country, in China, and in many other states. Our confidence in the victory of communism is based on knowledge of the laws governing the development of society, just as in its time capitalism took the place of feudalism, so will capitalism be inevitably superseded by communism, the more progressive and more equitable social system." And why is that, ladies and gentlemen? Because state-controlled capitalism always leads to communism and socialism. He knew that. Most of our State Department knew that. Much of our leadership knew that and knowingly allowed it to happen. Now you have to remember, though, communist leadership was never and is still not content with letting the inevitable, as it was said by Khrushchev, take place without a lot of aid and guidance from them. They believe that communism and socialism will come by revolution and that these revolutions must be developed, promoted, directed. In fact, communist leaders almost always avoided getting their countries directly involved in a war. Communism was not advanced simply by military means. In fact, Russia, under communist leadership, never actually started a war with another major power directly. Germany invaded Russia, for instance, and the Russians only declared war on Japan when victory for their side was certain. They have not been above, however, attacking small and weak countries. Let's look at Poland, Afghanistan, Finland. But they always avoided major undertakings militarily against major powers, using the tools of trade and subversion instead. But don't discount the military conquests they did entertain for their role in the expansion of communism and socialism. Countries in Eastern Europe, by the Red Army being conquered, set the stage for installing communist governments. It was quite clear. Communist governments usually resulted from conquests and seizures of power. But quite often, these were the result of civil wars, where communist and socialist agents were supported through the chains of command, traveling through Moscow and other centers of communist power, and through other major powers aiding and abetting their cause. And even through Red Army victories, if you will, there were always characteristic moves by which communists and socialists grabbed power. They usually went after countries where there were several parties that were more or less sympathetic with communists and socialists within their boundaries. Then the organizers and the agent provocateurs and the sales always helped to move these key people and parties into controlling positions and special appointments. And I mentioned already Hugh Seton Watson and reference his book. He was a famous historian, and you really should read his book. He found that typically in Eastern Europe, for instance, communist and socialist aggression took place in three phases. In the first phase, governments were formed by a coalition of left-wing parties. In the second stage, the communists and socialists actually gained control of the government. And in the third stage or phase, a one-party government was established, either by absorbing the others into one party under their control, or simply by removing them outright from power. And he also went on to say something very important about how communists and socialists got key positions in government and exercised that power. Quote, already in the first phase, the communists seized certain key positions. The most important of these was the Ministry of the Interior, which controlled the police. The Ministry of Justice, controlling the formal justice machinery, was considered less important but was held by communists and socialists in certain cases. Control of broadcasting was seized at an early date. Great efforts were made to create and control youth and women's organizations. And in industry, communists and socialists were placed in key positions in the management of nationalized factories and in trade unions. Now again, that was from Lenin to Malenkov by Seton Watson, the hyphenated last name I mentioned earlier. Now remember though, communism and socialism generally spread through the use of civil uprising, civil war, and unrest. And until the 1950s, for instance, these were generally promoted, directed, supported directly from Moscow. But From the 1950s on, other countries and other factions began getting into the controlling game, and I think most notably would be Communist China. Now remember, the main effort always put forth by communists and socialists has been to seize upon any weakness, whether it was real or imagined, that they could portray to a people of a given country, of any government, to promote disruption, disorder, discontent, galvanize classes into militancy, or anything else it might take to lead to revolt or revolution in a land. That's why we stress here on the Hour of the Time, it's not about revolution, it's about restoration. Now remember, the first step always that was used by cell groups and still is today, and you see it all the time, most notably in the newest and most powerful arm of socialism around the world, the Green Movement. They always get sympathizers, dupes, supporters, patsies to form a nucleus with organized zeal within a country. And then their first step is to gain control or influence over as many organizations and entities within that country as possible. Main leadership, party practitioners, one world orders, the insiders, if you will, provide the organized zeal within the country and often sends its own Carnegie-trained agents out there, or Ford Foundation agents, through the use of diplomatic appointments. But they'll not stoop and they'll not stop, ladies and gentlemen, at anything. How many of you have heard of Operation Snow White? Research it, ladies and gentlemen. You can see right there how socialists operate. Operation Snow White. Now, one of Stalin's key men, Otto Kucinin, describe part of the process this way. He said, quote, "We must create a whole solar system of organizations and smaller committees around the Communist Party, so to speak, smaller organizations working under the influence of our party and directors." And Willy Munzenberg, who was really an organizing genius, ladies and gentlemen, of the worldwide socialist movement, recommended that communists and socialists, quote, "must penetrate every conceivable milieu, get hold of artists and professors, make use of cinemas and theaters, and spread and defend communist and socialist ideas," end quote. And these types of activities, ladies and gentlemen, were going on in every country around the world already by the 1930s and earlier, even in some countries. And they were carried out more or less undercover, under the disguise of darkness, through appointments, cell groups, community action groups, etc. And remember, even Congress, finally, after investigation, declared in 1950 that it was a conspiracy to overthrow the government in every land in which these groups existed. Now remember all the new and unstable governments following World War II. We spoke about it, the newly freed protectorates, colonies, etc. Governments that already, and countries that were already major powers, broke down into minor powers. They were in disarray economically, industrially, militarily. And these were the vulnerable people to these attacks and tactics and ideas. Now remember, here is where the communist and socialist tactics changed. And you see it today. And every time I see one of those little bumper stickers or yellow ribbons or pictures of the Twin Towers, remember 9-1-1, I always think back to how in the official World Socialist Platform, one of their key things is always to go beyond spreading disorder, to always the use of violence, terror, to create chaos, fear, and promote warfare. Now, if you look at how the communists operated throughout Vietnam, for instance, you can get a good idea of this and something that everybody can, I think, relate to, whether it be through halfway done media, stories they've read, they've heard relatives talk, neighbors, etc. It's still close enough that I believe most people out there can halfway relate to it. If you're, you know, 22, 23 and under. Now, when France pulled out of Indochina, the Republic of Vietnam was organized as an independent country in 1954. And in fact, the country was also even referred to as South Vietnam. Socialists and communists immediately began pressing for power there. There was a power vacuum, as we stated earlier. Since they were already in power in North Vietnam, it was easy for them to do. And between 1957 and 1959, for instance, Vietnamese communists, better known as Viet Cong, killed 65 village chiefs. And Radio Hanoi, the voice of the communist and socialist movement in North Vietnam, proclaimed in 1959 the desirability of destroying the Diem regime in South Vietnam. And then the National Liberation Front was organized to liberate and re-educate and have an agrarian revolution in 1960 of South Vietnam. Now, if you look to one of our selected readings, for instance, that I gave you, and this will be about the last time I bounce back there, so I want to make sure I gave you the exact date. Yeah, I did. Our Vietnam Nightmare, Marguerite Higgins. I would suggest reading that book. Now, a lot of these books, because they're important, they're historical, they're factual, are easy to get for cheap, because no one wants to read that stuff anymore. They want to read absolute crap, and that's it. So you can get good books for cheap nowadays. Now, for instance, in her book, she cites how in 1960 and 1961, village officials, school teachers, and health workers were being murdered by the thousands. And for instance, the Viet Cong succeeded in closing 200 primary schools in South Vietnam, interrupting the education of more than 25,000 students. And this was simply a warning of the horrors to come, because this was just the beginning of the terror they were using that was about to explode into full force. This was the beginning, ladies and gentlemen, the re-education, the agrarian revolution, the new hope. Do you hear that again nowadays, ringing in political campaigns that toppled Vietnam into the communist camp? After World War II, socialism and communists struck out hard. Civil war had already long been underway in China. Although World War II, the general war, had kind of brought it to a halt temporarily. Now, if you'll remember, Chiang Kai-shek, which I detailed extensively to you on the air, our Chinese ally in China, before he was sold out by General Marshall and Truman and the Marshall Plan, wanted nothing more for China than an exact duplicate of our U.S. Constitution. And remember all the pilots that him and his raiders saved of ours from the torture and murder by Japanese troops. And how quickly that country is sold down the pipe to communist influence. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen. Because remember, in countries all around the world, your Laos's, Cambodia's, Vietnam's, China's, Russia's, Poland's, Hungary's, there was always a synonymous statement, like here in the United States or in Canada, and we detailed in three-part series how they were taken over by socialism, that the statement always was, it can't happen here. Ask a few hundred million dead people about that, ladies and gentlemen. Now, Soviet directed communism and socialism were taking their tolls on Turkey. They were a threat in the Middle East in the same time. They had a guerrilla war going on in Greece in 1947. Look up the Black Cat. Probably like Operation Snow White, something most of you have never heard of. I think you'll be quite amazed. Look up a few of these things. Look up the guerrilla warfare that occurred in Greece. Now, there was this huge failure of this entity that we still see today getting pushed and accelerated that failed from the very beginning. And it was envisioned by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, known communist and socialist, as would being the entity that was the great keeper of peace and settler of international disputes, and would take over and fill the role of what Woodrow Wilson had conceived of the defunct League of Nations, and we're talking about the United Nations. Now, Cordell Hull, another socialist, happened to be Roosevelt's Secretary of State, and he was a strong advocate of the idea. Now, on June 26, 1945, the United Nations Organization officially became into being with representatives, ladies and gentlemen. I think most of you know this, but we always are getting new listeners. Representatives from 50 nations met in San Francisco to sign the charter. But the idea of such an organization, what many of you may not know, had already been given currency, if you will, during World War II through a variety of actions. 26 nations, for instance, at war against the so-called Axis powers in January 1942 proclaimed themselves the United Nations. Then in 1943, representatives from the United States, United Kingdom, the Soviet Union, and China, remember that, 50% communist control, just like every head of the United Nations has been since its inception. United States, United Kingdom, Soviet Union, and China agreed to establish an organization for the United Nations as soon as possible. And remember, ladies and gentlemen, these were the dupes and patsies from China that were there at the meeting. Chiang Kai-shek wasn't invited. He was only a loyal constitutionalist aiding our GIs in a war. He wasn't worthy of being here. Now, Roosevelt worked to avoid all these pitfalls that kept the United States out of the League of Nations. And you can see his work and it's completely apparent in trying to get it accepted before the organization was even formed. Officially, in fact, although we all generally recognize and use or use the term allies, officially the United Nations was already being used in documentation. And remember that the major conferences for the organization were held in the United States at Dumbarton Oaks. Very important location, ladies and gentlemen. Check it out. And that is a residence in Washington, D.C. in 1944. And then in San Francisco in 1945. He courted Republican senators to try to reduce opposition from that side of the House or the Senate. Now remember, one of his greatest successes was getting Senator Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, who had been earlier a vigorous opponent of international entanglements, to support when he won him over to the United Nations idea. And in fact, as always, the carrot on the stick, the grant-making ability of the government, he got to serve as a delegate to the San Francisco Conference and helped to get the ratification of the charter through Senate with all but minor opposition. But the United Nations was always built upon a faulty premise: utopianism. Now that was implicit in Roosevelt's visions of the post-war world. And you might remember in his annual message to Congress in 1941, Roosevelt said, quote, "voiced a fervent hope for a post-war world built upon the four essential freedoms, freedom of speech and of worship, and freedom from want and fear," end quote. Now these four freedoms, ladies and gentlemen, became a symbol throughout the course of the war. And it became a symbol for all the Allies who were fighting, and a symbol for the brave new world that was supposed to emerge afterwards. The premise being that United Nations was that all the peoples of the world simply wanted peace, and that all nations of the world should be drawn together behind this goal. And that all people who joined the United Nations would commit themselves to avoid going to war to settle the disputes through negotiations and compromises. Compromise, ladies and gentlemen, is what got this country into the bucket it is in today. And generally, there is a rule that people do prefer peace to war if they can have it on their own terms and according to their own wills and whims. But it really doesn't matter what people may or may not want in a given country, because they're rarely, if ever, consulted before a nation goes to war anyway. In fact, it's actually unusual nowadays for parliaments, congresses, to be even consulted before a nation is committed to a war. I think we have a few examples of that too right now, don't we? Sudden invasions and undeclared wars become the rule more so than the exception. But one of the other key fallacies of the conception of the United Nations, ladies and gentlemen, was the assumption that all those who pushed for expansion of Soviet style communism and socialism in general, shared common ground and common goals with countries who didn't want to see that spread. It wasn't the case then, it never will be. Socialist leaders and communist leaders are bent on promoting world revolution. Those of us who believe in freedom cannot sit in some building and compromise and talk happily to each other and get anywhere. It's impossible. And in fact, those who promote socialism on a worldwide scale love tools like the United Nations because there they get to spread their disorder and antagonism to those who believe in freedom. Because remember, world peace can only prevail in the view of socialists when every challenge to socialism has been removed from the world. So obviously the very premise of a United Nations organization is faulty from the beginning. Now I want to just give you a brief biographical highlight of one man in particular that we'll get more into in the next broadcast in this series. Dean Acheson. He lived from 1893 to 1971. He was President Truman's Secretary of State from 1949 to 1953. Now, he had, for several years, worked in the State Department, one of the most traitorous organizations in the executive that our country has ever seen. He was born in Connecticut, went to Yale and Harvard Law School. After admission to the bar, he alternated between the practice of law and political positions in Washington. And, oh, guess what? He played a prominent role in implementing the Marshall Plan, in shaping the North Atlantic Treaty, and guided the United States' participation in the Korean War within the framework of the United Nations.